Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. It's me, Chris, and Jason. Say hi, Jason.
Oh, hey.
Kevin.
Hey.
Ben.
Hey.
And we've got with us a special guest, an old comrade of ours from back in the hyperactive Trotskyist days, Byron. Say what's up, Byron.
Hi, everyone.
So, Byron is a doctor. We'll be referring to him as Dr. Byron throughout the show. And is actually coming on the show to talk to us about mental health, the practice of psychology and psychiatry, and the left. And we've got a broad swath of different things to talk about now. But Byron, why don't you just kind of let everyone know a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name's Byron. I know all these gentlemen from our previous activism days within the ISO. After all that, I went on to medical school. I'm currently a psychiatry resident. Been doing that for a few years. A father of two. And I'm here to talk about leftist perspectives on, you know, I guess what we call mental health or psychiatry, psychology. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Well, Kevin left.
That was enough like, for him.
He's like, I'm not listening to Byron say all this bullshit. So, Byron, so you sent us a bunch of stuff that you thought was interesting to read. I will link all of this stuff in our show notes for our listeners. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting, and it kind of sort of just instinctually jived with how I feel, so that's why I liked it a lot and thought it's probably true, was the article that you sent us.
Confirmation bias.
Right, exactly. It's the article that you sent to us called "This Is Not the Way to Help Depressed Teenagers," and it's from the New York Times. And essentially, it talks about the way that by trying to help teenagers in high school, there are a bunch of programs that cast a real wide net and just assume that all teenagers have mental issues that they need worked out in assemblies and through group exercises and stuff like that. And what is tending to happen is it's making everyone more depressed. Or if kids weren't depressed, they're perfectly happy, they come out the other end of these sorts of activities depressed. Because, you know, in a lot of instances, they're just sad sometimes and happy sometimes, but they're taught that actually what you have is some sort of problem, and you should be focusing on every time you feel bad constantly. And I don't know,
right, like, you don't just have a thing that's making you anxious right now. You have anxiety as a condition and things like that.
Right. So I know that immediately a lot of people are going to hear this, and their hackles are going to go up because this is completely against the sort of like therapeutic culture of the left, where mental health is seen as like taking self-care as a revolutionary act, shit like that, you know? So it's like to see that there are multiple studies, and this is this, I believe there's another article in here that talks about studies in the UK and Australia and stuff that have similar effects. So I don't know, just what are your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, so the, you know, if your audience wants to either read that New York Times article or actually read the study that I think the New York Times article in particular was based on, it was a study that was published in, I think, 2022 or 2023 called the Wise Teens Study. And it made kind of a big splash, as you can imagine. I mean, the New York Times picked up on it, but it's talked a lot about, in the psychiatry spheres the last year or two. And there's what it showed and what other articles are starting to, or studies are starting to show, is that perhaps this universal approach to providing little bits of mental health to everyone at a young age may not be as helpful as we once thought. And maybe there are some unintended consequences. And I don't want to oversell that and saying these studies show that no child should go to therapy or something like that.
Right.
But, you know, what those studies, and there's another one that was on, this, what they're calling that, like, microtherapy that they're doing through TikTok, which we can talk about TikTok and psychology if y'all want, because that's its own little bizarre phenomenon.
TikTok makes kids.
I mean, well, I have a.
I'll edit that out so we don't sound like Red Scare.
I have a prejudice against TikTok, and maybe we should talk about it, because if I should not, the only one who could maybe convince me is a professional like you, Byron.
No.
Sure. I mean, you definitely should. I mean, it's pretty much universally despised within our field for a variety of reasons. But one of the most common is that we have patients coming to us all the time that come into our office and are like, I already know what the problem is. I know my diagnosis. You're like, whoa, that's kind of strange. What's going on? And they like, I did this test that I learned from TikTok where, based on this, I know that I have PTSD, or more commonly, you know, what people call like split personality disorder, which that's not its official diagnosis. That's essentially what they're saying. But they're always wrong. You know, like 99% of the time it's just wrong. That's not true. That's not their diagnosis. If they have
what one a surprise, all, they're always wrong.
Yeah. So that in itself is a problem. And then a lot of the teenagers that are on that platform are highly suggestible. Their kind of personality traits kind of align themselves to be highly suggestible people. And there's a lot of, you know, quote unquote influencers on there that are genuinely convincing teenagers that they have things going on with them that simply aren't so. They don't actually have 15 personalities that they can split in and out of on a dime. That's not what's happening.
What's the other one that I read an article about that was like going around TikTok? It was like people with verbal tics and whatever.
That was
running around TikTok. But then whenever they go into get diagnosed, these verbal tics and whatever, like the things where you spasm and stuff, those suddenly start like disappearing whenever the kids engage in an activity that they enjoy or something like that.
Yeah, and it's always been known that people with that have like tics or Tourette's or whatever.
Tourette's, that was the word.
They're like in a public education setting. If you have two children with that diagnosis, you often want to keep them in different classrooms because they will start bouncing off each other. Like one will set the other one off. And so there is an element of just suggestibility within that diagnosis. But then you have kids that if they were not watching TikTok, they would have never developed these symptoms ever. You know, they've studied that multiple times. And the first time I ever heard about this was this neurologist was giving a talk to us during Grand Rounds. And he was like, have you heard of these TikTok tics? And I thought he was joking, like TikTok tics. That's kind of a funny term.
Right.
Then he was like, and everyone laughed, and he was like, no, I'm serious. And this was back in like 2020, 2021, when it was first starting to be written about. But since then, there's been multiple studies that have been published on it showing that the incidence of it happening is like going way through the roof, likely because of TikTok. So there's a whole lot of just kind of broadly pathologies that are developing that wouldn't have otherwise because of social media. But you know, getting back to that Wise Teen study, you know, especially since COVID. Sorry if you can hear my kids in the background.
No, that's definitely awesome. Okay. Yeah,
kids rule. I'm a dad now, so I'm like, whenever I hear kids, I just get happy. Whereas before I was a dad, I would hear kids and be like, oh, shut up, kids. You know, it's like, wow, I was really fucking antisocial before I had kids.
Man, I have I'm just completely normal and neutral about it. I'm just like, yeah, some people have kids and there's like kids making noises.
No, I mean, like hearing kids doesn't bother me, but like kids crying in the grocery store or screaming or whatever, I'd be like, oh, shut up. But now I'm just kind of like, oh, poor kids, you know?
But essentially especially since COVID, there's been this huge push for mental health in the youth that has made its way onto platforms like TikTok, where there are therapists that are doing like microtherapies, you know, It has made its way into public education where they're doing this kind of universal approach of, I forget what they call it. I think the article talks about specifically what it's called, but it's like emotional education or something like that. But it's essentially like a micro version of therapy and being conscious of our feelings and talking about them and all those sort of things that, you know, on the surface sound great. You know, if someone came to me and said, like, is it good for kids to tap into how they're feeling? Like of course.
Yeah. It's called social emotional skills training. Sorry.
Yeah. Exactly. That's it. My nieces. So I have an older sister and my nieces are going through that right now. And it was so funny. Before I even read this article, my sister was telling me, she's like, I think it's actually making them more emotional. Like it's making them kind of worse off. I just kind of shrugged it away, but then some research started coming out. I was like, maybe there's something to that. So that it's kind of begged the question, is this helpful? Is this making kids more resilient? And there's been a few studies now that are suggesting that maybe perhaps it's not, and maybe there are unintended consequences. And some of the explanations that have been put forward by some pretty prominent, this isn't like some kooky idea. These are very prominent psychologists talking about this, that you know, you are kind of asking children that have some level of anxiety, like we all do, to ruminate on their problems, to think about them on a deeper level and for longer periods of time than they probably would have otherwise.
Yeah.
And if you're not, especially if you're not following that up with a full-fledged therapeutic approach, then maybe you're just having them think about these problems and not even giving them the skills to work through them.
Right.
And so that was, you know, that was at least one of the things I thought about with the Wise Teen study that I sent you, or the article about it at least, was that if you read the paper, you know, they do like kind of a micro mini version of DBT, which is, you know, everyone's heard of CBT, but it's a different tool set. Still a therapy model, but it's intense. Like real DBT takes a lot of time, and not just like in a single session, but over the course of months. And it's for particular pathologies, in particular some personality disorders.
That stands for dialectical behavioral therapy for people who don't
know. And it's most commonly used for cluster B, like borderline personality disorders. But, you know, what they did by necessity is just kind of a mini version of that, which is also what they're doing in most schools.
Right.
So it just seems that maybe a half measure of therapy while also inviting them to dwell on their problems is doing more harm than good, which I think sounds plausible, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it mm-hmm. sounds intuitively true to me.
It definitely does to me. I feel like there's also part of what's so what, you know, when kids like are on TikTok or whatever and see a disorder and then start, adopting it for themselves. I mean, people see all sorts of things that they don't adopt for themselves, but they're operating in a social context where there's specific systems of rewards and punishments in place, and everybody's living in whatever, you know, shitty conditions we have, or, you know, some just regular ass kids and living their boring ass suburban lives or whatever, have nothing important or special going on for them. But whenever they get told, people who have a disorder, they get special attention, they get excuse for violating social norms, they get to act out in different ways and it's okay, they get special accommodations and special attention, and they have a personality trait that they can then like make their life around having this disorder. So there's like this like system of rewards that kids get for claiming to have some sort of diagnosed condition of whatever sort, autistic, Tourette's, split personality,
right.
ADHD, whatever it is. They've got an excuse for why their life is, why they're not succeeding and excelling in life, why they're just a mediocre, boring kid in the suburbs or whatever. And I think there's something deeply, deeply fucking wrong and bad and decadent about a society that is cultivating vices in its children.
This study kind of seems like it can be broadened. It's just a microcosm of pretty much everybody in the United States at this point who's being given a set of ways to think, a set of vocabulary to talk about everyday problems, and the encouragement to focus on major and minor problems that they may have, and to pathologize every single little thing about their lives, and then not actually being given the tools to deal with that, right? So it's like what's happening to these kids via these programs in schools is what's happening to everybody on the internet on a regular basis all the time. And like Kevin mentioned, for adults too, there's like sort of a social cachet to be had in talking about, oh yes, I'm a complex PTSD survivor or something like that. People like, just go look at Twitter. It's the leftists on Twitter. Everybody lists their mental illnesses in their bio, which is fucking insane to me. Like, I don't know why.
Yeah.
That's something you think everybody needs to know about, right? But, you know, I'm just old, I guess.
It's almost like the hyper-individuated way that we live of autonomous selves, entirely disconnected, at least theoretically disconnected from the whole, from the totality. A whole bunch of particulars, but not a universal, but also at the same time in competition with each other. And also, we've made, let's say, attention and celebrity, especially if it's connected at all to like any concept of like, let's say, I'm trying to think of a better way to say this, in oppression. But yeah, it's almost as though that is a bad idea.
Well, I also, that actually, one of the points I was thinking about making, but then just didn't, is that listing PTSD or something like that puts you into a category of not just being a regular ass white person, because, you know, white people are bad.
Right.
But if you're a special kind of white person that has mental illness from maltreatment or something by someone or something in the past, then you're not just a white person. You're a white person with an asterisk, meaning like you're part of a special community that is also oppressed.
Right. Yeah,
I'm not saying that people aren't oppressed, but yeah. And,
right.
And it's good that you said that. Social cachet.
Just to ruminate on this.
It's good that you said that, because I did not, and that's what I was hinting at, but without explaining it, it sounds like I just don't believe that anybody's oppressed. So I'm glad you brought up the other end.
Yeah.
But this, just to ruminate briefly on this, because I want to get back to Byron, but so we've talked in past episodes about the way that our politics has been removed from actual terrain into the discursive. And so this is like the pop psychology version of fighting against different kinds of oppression being turned into like an academy's kind of politically correct vernacular, diversity, equity, inclusion sort of language scheme. And so there's like a pop psychology version of that in which you can impose virtue signaling and kind of basically creating fodder for the right, you know, in which you're putting your own victimhood and the ladder of oppression schema up for grabs. It is intuitive, but also like experiential for me, what the Lucy Fulks, the Oxford psychologist, in this Times piece calls prevalence inflation, which is what you were describing, Byron. And I can speak to it. I want to hear more from you, but like I was a young person who was diagnosed with comorbid diagnoses, and I definitely did have something that qualified as major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. And so there is like it did help me to have something by which to understand what I was going through, but it also like I think also waylaid me for many years, even into the 20s and even 30s. Like this it becomes a way of putting you in this learned helplessness kind of construct in which you can't move beyond it, because it is the way that you construct your entire identity. The way that this article puts it, these sorts of labels begin to dictate how people view themselves in ways that become self-fulfilling. So that definitely maps onto my own experience in the this entire industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for us to talk about diagnoses and talk about them with the patients, and you know, the DSM. There's only like two diagnoses in the entire DSM in which I can order a lab and get a result and say you have this diagnosis. They're almost exclusively pattern recognition and putting people into these like little statistical silos that we have said, if you have these traits at this timeline, then we call that this diagnosis. And then we, based on that, we have done studies that show that these medications are helpful for that, for these categories and these statistical, you know, findings that we've done. And so they're helpful in that way, but they're in this, kind of like we all were saying, in this environment of where people are kind of encouraged to bring that into their identity, it can almost be harmful in that it just carries with them forever. Whereas really a good psychologist and a good psychiatrist, I can't speak for everyone, but I can speak for myself. I want my patients to come and see me, and then after a time, never come back. I never want to see them again.
Yeah.
Right. I want them to go on with their lives. And I don't know if you want to talk about psychoanalysis, but this is sometimes where I'm a little skeptical of my colleagues that do psychoanalysis and see like their patients for decades and they get paid. Sometimes I have some thoughts about what's really happening here. Like, what is really this relationship?
Well, certainly maybe some people maybe could use like a long-term plan of deep, deep analysis. And some people very clearly do not.
Right. Yeah. And so and this is one of the ways that I got into psychiatry was when I first saw a middle-aged man. The first person I ever saw when I was in med school on my psychiatry rotation made me think this is what I want to do was a middle-aged man who was in a manic episode. He had bipolar 1 and he was manic. And, when you see mania, you know that this is a very serious medical condition. There's no ignoring it. This is not, he didn't think his way into this. This isn't an act. You know, this is either going to result in a hospitalization, imprisonment, or they're going to die. I mean, those are basically the three outcomes of untreated mania. And when I saw that, I thought, okay, this is a very serious medical field treating very, grievous, injurious medical conditions. And that's what I found it very interesting. And that's what I wanted to do. But then when I started,
it's also very cerebral. So I think that like really fits with your personality.
Right.
As a smart guy, I like to read a lot of books all the time.
Whereas a lot of other medical fields, not to dig on my colleagues, but like say like OBGYN, shout out to them, but they by and large do not make independent decisions. They have algorithms that they can look at and say pregnant woman is X amount of weeks pregnant and she's having this symptom. What does they call it ACOG. It's like their society that makes all the rules. What do they say I should do next? And they just follow the graph and say, okay, that's what I'm going to do. None of that, that hardly exists in psychiatry. it's still the Wild West. And so it's still pretty cerebral. That's one of the, yeah, you're right. That is one of the reasons I liked it. But then when I got into when I started doing training, and in particular an outpatient, I started seeing a lot of people that have been patients for years that I was just skeptical they really needed to be there. I thought that based on how well they were doing that they could probably be managed on an outpatient basis by like their family medicine doctor who was going to continue to prescribe these medicines. Like they were stable. They didn't really need to continue to see a specialist, but there is this sort of drive and incentive to keep patients coming back, like keeping them like on the docket as like your patient. But I guess that's all to say, like, I like the psychiatry where I am dealing with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, PTSD, things that untreated make life very difficult to go through. Major depressive disorder, severe, where they're acutely suicidal, stuff like that. I really enjoy working with those patients, and I see a benefit to them seeing a professional. That's the kind of psychiatry I like to practice. But more and more, I just keep seeing people getting more and more interested in mental health and them ascribing labels to themselves that I don't think are actually serving them or entirely accurate. Like Chris, you brought up everyone and everyone on Twitter being diagnosed with PTSD, or especially self-diagnosed with PTSD or complex PTSD, which in psychiatry, we don't even recognize the term complex PTSD. It's not a real thing to us. It's kind of a psychology term. I don't even know what to do with it when people tell me about it, but PTSD is not something I'd wish on my worst enemy. It's life altering. A person with true PTSD that faced some sort of life threatening event, and they are experiencing symptoms from that, like avoidance symptoms, so on and so forth. They need serious help, and it shouldn't be. I don't think it should be trivialized, and I don't think it's a label that people should take on lightly.
Yeah,
it's very serious, and you know, and that's one of the, you know, I brought up TikTok earlier about people self-diagnosing. That's one of the most common ones, along with like dissociative identity disorder. People. Being like, well, I watched this TikTok, and at the end of the video, I learned that I have PTSD. It's like 99% true, a 99% chance that it's not true.
So there's a big conflation, I think, with all traumatic incidents and PTSD. Because, like, we've all experienced traumas, right? Of some sort in our lives. But that does not mean that everyone that has ever experienced a trauma has PTSD. Do you have an aversion to this or to that because one time when you did it, you got hurt, whatever? Yes. Is that PTSD? I don't think so.
Or even that PTSDs are all the same. Like,
right.
This is something that we get into with the Danielle Carr interview you sent us, which I thought was really fantastic, Byron.
Probably the best one.
Yeah, where she's talking about traumatic literalism. Is that what it is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where basically... you know, someone who's a veteran of the Iraq war and someone who survives like spousal abuse or something can all be put into the same category that is PTSD. And that's also maybe it's different, but like, so there's the medical designation of someone with bipolar or schizophrenia versus something like depression, which she says, like, it's more of a conceptual category than a biological one because they don't exhibit the same on a neurological level. There's no guarantee that one person's disease is going to be neurologically or biologically the same as another's. And that's definitely my experience going through this, being churned through this as a young person. Like, also I remember being diagnosed and it was literally just me describing what I was feeling. And they're like, oh, okay. Major depressive disorder. Okay. Anxiety disorder. Okay. OCD. It's like, it was very strange. I was like, that's how diagnosis works.
That is how. So, I mean, in order to get a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, you need to have, 5 out of 9 symptoms. And like the 9 symptoms are like, you know, depressed mood, suicidal ideations, guilt, disturbed sleep. That can be more sleep or less sleep, change in appetite, that can be more hunger or less hunger, and so forth. And so they're just descriptive. And if the psychiatrist or psychologist is doing a good job, they won't feed the patient. Like, they won't feed them, how are you getting more or less sleep? Or do you have a hard time concentrating? You know, kind of like implanting these ideas into people's heads. Just not to say that, like, well, I guess what I'm saying is when you see a patient that has gone through the system several times and like I interview them, they'll say, I'm depressed. And I'll say, and if you're trained well, you'll say something to the effect of like, can you describe that to me? Like, what's been going on? And you can tell when a patient has been seeing a psychiatrist or psychologist for a long time that has been feeding them symptoms, because they'll say, well, I have suicidal ideations. I have increased perception of guilt. My appetite has, and it'll start listing like the DSM criteria. And you're like, well, I don't know if this is really happening or if if you've just been taught this lingo that we use to categorize, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, you were bringing up how, you know, the biology can be different even within the same diagnosis. And the whole neurobiology thing within psychiatry was a big deal back in the 80s and 90s in particular, where everyone was convinced that through MRIs and other advanced imaging and serum levels of serotonin and blah, 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 that we were going to be able to figure out exactly what the neurobiology of PTSD is, or the neurobiology of bipolar is. And that would improve our treatments. And to make a long story short, it's all turned out to be pretty bad science. Everything that we thought so far about, well, in depression, this area of the brain shrinks, and so that area must be the result of these sad feelings. Wrong. It turned out to be wrong.
I mean, it's weird because, like, that's been my experience. Without going into detail, I've been through some rough times as an adult, and I have been prescribed things which have just had exactly no, let's say, no positive effect. Mm-hmm. And everybody that knows anything about it just continually just keep trying. You have to try something else. Eventually you'll figure out the right mixture for your brain, the chemicals in your brain or whatever. At a certain point, I just decided, like, well, I don't even care what anybody thinks. I don't care what the science is. This does not work for me. And it's nice to have my knee-jerk sentiments verified so much.
Well, you know, probably we have a couple cornerstone landmark trials within psychiatry, and say, like, the one for antidepressants is called the STAR-D trial. And there was always a question of, someone comes to you with depression, and we have 30 antidepressants with different class, you know, different mechanisms of action. Which one do we choose? And then if they fail one, does that mean that we need to choose a totally different category? You know, there was a lot of questions around that. And like a lot of things in psychiatry, people were just going based on what had worked for them in the past. There was no like concrete scientific explanation as to why you should choose one or the other, or what you should do after the first failed trial or second failed trial. And so STAR-D tried to answer that question. And in the end, one of the takeaways was, within the SSR, you know, everyone's heard of SSRIs. There's also SNRIs and other kinds of antidepressants like mirtazapine, stuff like that. The answer ended up being, we have no way of knowing. And if you just get a dartboard and throw a dart at it, that's totally legitimate. You know, start with Lexapro, okay, or don't. Or start with this other one. Start with Effexor. In one failed trial within an SSRI category does not really inform if you are or not going to respond to another SSRI, or if you should move to another category of antidepressants. So,
I would just, my advice to anyone listening would just be psychedelics and go to mass.
Psychedelics are another, you know, interesting topic within psychiatry. I'm waiting to reserve my judgment for another decade or two until we have more and more research. You know, when ketamine hit the market, there was several studies that came out immediately saying that it was the best thing ever. That you know, the early days of ketamine research showed a dramatic remission in acute suicidal ideations and suicide attempts. I mean, it blew everything out of the water as far as comparisons to like the drugs that we typically use. It wasn't even close. And people started using it. Subsequent research has really put a wet blanket on it.
But I thought that was specifically in the context of like heroic doses of mushrooms under administrated by like a therapist or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, so what I guess what I was getting to is that the ketamine research has started to be more and more questionable as to, was it as effective as the first studies suggested that it was? And I wonder if that's not going to happen with this psychedelics research. We're still in the early days. You know, there's a lot of legality of what can and can't be studied, so it makes it difficult to do good quality research. But we do have a few trials, and it seems to be pretty awesome. And if it ends up being a wonder drug, then I think that it'll probably just be a mainstay for psychiatrists. I mean, it might put psychiatry out of business.
Well, you know,
but
no, you know,
I'm waiting to decide whether or not I think it's great or not, because I think there's a whole lot of people wanting it to be good. You know, people want to do mushrooms. I mean,
yeah,
why not? I mean, that sounds way better than doing Lexapro. You know,
I mean, if people want to do mushrooms, they should just go do mushrooms. But
I
have to make
excuses. I would add what I said before: psychedelics, and then go to mass. But also, you have to do things in your own life that fundamentally change what's happening to make you sad, because there's no such thing as a wonder drug.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yes. I just wanted to respond to you, Jason. And Byron. I've been decades of psychotherapy and prescribed drugs. I've taken the whole gamut of SSRIs and even the older ones. And I was fed from the get-go as if it was hard science, like the serotonin thesis, right? And lo and behold, I learn, you know, in a biopsych class 20 years later, that has pretty much been laid to decimated.
Totally bonk.
But that's not to say that these SSRIs and other things are not benefiting people and are not helping people. So it's not that they don't work for some people. I am taking Lexapro now, and it has absolutely been a game changer. And in previous iterations, other medications were absolutely life-saving. And here's another thing. After we've learned it's bunk, I have gone to clinics, whatever, and heard the thing still being said to me.
That's pretty bad.
Like, not getting through the entire industry that this is no longer, you know, how what the science is showing us.
So
it's a lot like how you know, you learned in middle school that the Aztecs worshipped the Spaniards as gods, and then later on, it turns out that nobody has actually thought that for like 50 years. It just hasn't yet made it into the textbooks.
Well, in institutional inertia,
Our field has not thought that increasing serotonin levels directly translates into remission of depression. We haven't thought that for a long time, decades and decades. And it's a really easy test. If it was just about serotonin levels, then an SSRI would work within a couple of days.
Right.
It raises serotonin levels very quickly. But if anyone that knows what they're talking about is prescribing it to you, they will tell you this is probably not going to start working for it at the earliest 4 weeks. At the earliest, it should not, outside of placebo effect, it should not start working for 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. And so clearly, it's just not about it just the serum levels of serotonin, right? I've read kind of more modern research on the topic, and it's still pretty convoluted. I don't know that I fully understand it, talking about, well, the serotonin levels rise and that upregulates certain pathways in the brain and blah, blah, blah. It still sounds very speculative to me. It's not fully worked out like most things in psychiatry, but we do know, again, getting back to like the kind of categorical way that we diagnose people with a DSM, we do know that if you have major depressive disorder, severe type, if you meet that criteria, research has shown for years and years and years that SSRIs are helpful for that population. But anyone weaving a story as to like exactly why the people that study this for a living do not fully understand exactly why.
So they're effective, right? But for about a 40% effective rate, from what I understand.
So if you qualify for MDD severe, then what, you know, I talked about STARDI earlier, that research showed that about a third of the patients responded well to their first round of antidepressant medication. Mm-hmm. So you take that third of the 100% pie out. you switch them, you take the 66% that did not respond, and you give them a different kind, either another SSRI, an SNRI, mirtazapine, whatever, Wellbutrin. About a third of them won't respond positively. And at the end of doing multiple switches like that, the study showed that about 70% of all patients did positively respond. So yeah, you know, I'm not sure about the 40%. Okay. I'm sure the other studies have shown probably 40%. So, but that's still in line, you know, one third to 40%. But usually you can do medication switches and you will help most people. But the point is that the patient needs to usually, they need to meet the criteria for severe type depression.
Right.
If it's mild to moderate, research has consistently shown that medications are equally as effective or not as effective as just therapy.
Yeah.
So that those patients just don't need medications, period. You know, if
right. I think the thing that
or,
I saw,
or like dancing, or like getting exercise,
or ecstatic right. dancing.
Yeah. What the thing that I'm talking about was, I think, an aggregate of all prescriptions led to about a 40% total success rate. It was one of the pieces of material that we referenced in the episode that we did with Adam about mental health and psychedelics and religion. Because he's a therapist that practices a biopsychosocial model of treatment or whatever.
Well, that's like a frame. Biopsychosocial is a I'd be interesting if that is like if that is its own category. Maybe I'm totally ignorant to it. But when we talk about biopsychosocial, it typically is like a framework of understanding pathology and the patient. So, you know, we went through a time
where I'm probably misremembering.
Everyone was. Depression was looked at purely biological.
Right.
And it doesn't take much critical thinking to realize that if someone is depressed because their spouse is abusive or their local factory closed and their job is no longer there, or, you know, whether you're suffering something in your interpersonal life or, you know, kind of on a grander scale through the economy, that medications can only do so much. We have to think of the person as a whole being, right? And they don't just exist as like an animated meat sack. They also have this like psychosocial part, right? That's very meaningful and needs to be taken into account.
Right. In fact, that's actually what our personalities are.
Mm-hmm.
We don't develop them by ourselves and then go out into the world and then display it. It's a constant. It's always being shaped by everything else around us as well as by us.
Right. So actually, Danielle Carr talks about using the biopsychosocial model as a way of taking a more dialectical materialist approach to mental health, saying that positing disease categories is not a value neutral act. There's no diagnosis from the purely biological vantage. And a psychiatric disease category isn't just a name for a thing that really exists in the world. Built into that category are all kinds of ideas about causality. So like how we conceptually frame diagnosis in and of itself, we're, like you say, Byron, we're just kind of inheriting what she says. Psychiatry as a field is largely defined by a liberal conceptual vocabulary. And so we're inheriting all these limitations into how you even approach something like depression. She's advocating for a different set of concepts for thinking about suffering and psychiatric illness.
I was looking for the specific type of therapeutic practice that Adam says that he did. I don't remember what it is now, but it's a multi-pronged approach that's like, because he's a, I guess he's got his master's degree in social work, and he does like psychoanalysis as part of his social work, right? Like therapy as part of the social work. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was a multi-pronged approach that took all different things into consideration, and biopsychosocial sounded like it was the right thing, but that's probably just a word that I picked up from the articles that you sent us. So.
Kind of going off of what Ben was saying, I mean, like, so right now I'm doing a couple months of inpatient child and adolescent work, and I don't enjoy it, for one, because whenever I see some of these patients, I think about my own children, and it makes me very sad.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I can, if this is like my entire professional life, I don't know that I could do it, because I don't think I want to be depressed all the time thinking about my kids. But, you know, and then I'm sad because their children are obviously just victims, right? Children, a lot of these diagnoses that we give kids are just a roundabout way of saying, for the most part, they're roundabout ways of saying they have experienced severe trauma. You know, someone can have a totally normal life, you know, air quotes normal, and develop schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. It's just, there's a genetic component, and then there's an environmental component, this what we call like a two-hit hypothesis, but there's a big genetic component to it, and it's just bad luck, right? But for a child at the age of 12 to develop some of these behaviors that we diagnose this with them with, like disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, just stuff like that. It's coded language for they have experienced some sort of physical or sexual trauma oftentimes, and this is a learned behavior secondary to those events. And what, you know, what those kids really need is something that we cannot provide within our field. You know, like, we need to radically change their home life. We need to erase history. Oftentimes, they need to be, those are the kind of kids that do need to be in intensive therapy, right? To help so that they can move past these things, or, you know, develop better coping strategies for these things that happen to them. But instead, oftentimes, I just feel like we label them with this diagnosis, and then that kind of puts a stigma on them, and we just kind of treat them with medications and move on.
Yeah.
The entire approach to it can be a little frustrating at times.
So in the episode that we did with Adam, one of the things that we talked about was that is actually one of the subject of one of the articles that you sent us, is that a majority of the mental illnesses, right, that people are afflicted with are have social roots. And of course, there's a biological component for some people. Some people are biologically predispositioned to dealing with adversity in a way that would give them blank mental illness, like whatever, depression, severe depression, whatever. But that not everyone does, and no one knows why. But that at the root of most of these are social problems. There's some sort of conditioning that's causing these things to happen, and at the root of all of that is, like, you know, our society. It's capitalism. It's, you know, the extremely alienated form of capitalism that we live under. It's the media that people are exposed to, the interpersonal relationships that people have, and the way that people interact with each other as a result of being conditioned to be selfish and predatory, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at the root of it all, there's a social, an intense social, an intense, a massive social component that probably overshadows everything else. And as a doctor of, what is it, psychology?
Psychiatry.
That's a doctor of psychiatry.
Doctor of medicine, but then
doctor of medicine.
With training in psychiatry. Yeah.
With training in psychiatry. There we go. What do you say to that?
The about this, there being like a social component to these?
That the social component is probably the most important part of it. And then the biological component is somewhat incidental.
Well, I mean, I don't want to underplay the biological component. You know, two people can grow up in the same household and experience very similar adverse events, but have drastically different reactions to it.
Right.
And there, you know, and stuff like that, there might be a biological component to it. I mean, there probably most certainly is. But sorry, my daughter was knocking on the door, and it made me distracted.
So specifically, though, we're talking about depression, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone is depressed, right? Everyone's clinically depressed, quote unquote. Right? Like, I don't know how many people you meet on a regular basis that are like, oh yeah, I have depression. I'm like, yeah, well, me too sometimes, like when bad things happen or whatever. But well,
you know what's interesting is I feel like since I left LA, the number of people who have depression seems to have dropped precipitously.
Is that because LA, it makes everyone depressed, or
I think it's just vocabulary. It's a cultural difference,
right?
But yeah,
you do see say like a very hard marker like death by suicide, you know, that's that's a very serious endpoint that can be kind of clearly studied. You see different rates of that within the same country in different demographics within that country. Say like if you're comparing like death by suicide rates among white people versus African Americans and within the United States and so on and so forth, and you can see pretty clear differences. And it's often speculated that there's like a cultural component to that, like whether we're talking about resiliency or seeking help or not seeking help. There are definitely cultural and societal components to all of this. You know, one of the most at-risk groups within this country, at least, I'm not sure about globally, but in this country are middle-aged white guys.
Yeah.
And that's also one of the most lonely populations within this country, right? I mean, you can find all sorts of articles about the issue with middle-aged male loneliness, where they're essentially their only friend is their wife, if they have one, right? And then if their wife passes or they get divorced or whatever, they're completely socially isolated.
I've been informed by leftists on the internet that that's not a real thing. White What's male not? Loneliness.
Either that or that it's a good thing and finally it's happening.
Yeah, they deserve it, yeah.
Yeah. Those people are... I haven't actually seen that. I'm glad I haven't seen that.
I'm glad you haven't seen that as well, because
I'll send you a video, and it'll
the worst thing.
Ruin your day.
The TikTok explanation for why it's a good thing, and isn't happening.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know, so you know, would that be happening if they weren't completely alienated, isolated? They have no sense of community. Like if those things were all gone, like they were a part of a whatever, some sort of healthy like male group or church that was active. You know, people used to be in bowling clubs. People used to have all sorts of different societal and like local things that they were attached to that helped them, you know, gather some sort of meaning. That's all kind of going away.
Yeah.
Everyone's just an atomized little individual. And when you get to that age where if you had kids, they're out of the house and it's just you and your partner, if you even have one, I imagine that those rates of depression and completed suicide would be dramatically different in a better functioning, cultural milieu. I mean, I think that's just kind of self-evident, but,
yeah.
Well, I feel like, I mean, so obviously, like even the first article says that teen depression is a structural problem that requires structural solutions, which would involve training a much bigger pool of therapists to do actual therapy and not this kind of whatever this micro failed experiment was. But
HR-ified therapy, yeah. Like,
but there's
everyone go to your mandatory once a week therapy in a group, regardless of your situation, that kind of a thing.
But this kind of leads us to Danielle Carr's really astute, the closing of that interview. She says the anti-psychiatry movement's biggest failure was that it took the biological to be the opposite of the political, rather than a site where politics happens. So, like, the structural ills are going to compound the biological. It's not a question of, I think that was so like R.D. Lang and his ilk had profound insights into the ways that psychiatry has tried to enclose mental illness, and especially in the neoliberal age, individualize it and atomize it. But that doesn't mean that we can kind of dispense with everything we learn from the science of psychiatry, and then the ways in which capitalism has used science means we can do without science, you know.
Hold on real quick. There's some fidgeting going on. That's someone's microphone is picking up very well. It's like a clicking of a pen or something. I think that might
you
be
better. Are you hanging right now?
I'm sitting here muted, so.
Let me mute because that is definitely my son hitting a drum.
No, there was that. I hear that too in the background. That's not that big of a deal, but there was some like someone clicking a pen and then dropping it on the desk that sounded like.
Was it this?
Yes.
I was thinking I was fidgeting with the pen. So.
Yeah, it's incredibly loud. And like it's while you were talking, so I can't edit it out, you know? So be mindful. Practice mindfulness, Ben.
Do you want me to say it all again?
No. It's all right. You're fine. But just in the future, don't do that.
Can you hear my son drumming still?
Yes. It's all right. Yeah, it's not a big
deal.
That's cool.
That's a good sound.
So there have been times like on the Discord and then broadly on the left, you know, topics like CBT will come up, and oftentimes people will make little kind of meme comments about, you know, CBT is just, it's bad because that's just when they tell you that instead of bad thoughts, you should have only good thoughts.
That's pretty much exactly what, whenever I was diagnosed major depressive disorder and my doctor prescribed me vitamin D and B12 and talk therapy. And I went to the talk therapist and she did, I think it was CBT, but something, probably one of those ones like that. And that was exactly what, the engagement with her was like. It was just, she was just like, instead of being sad, you should be happy. And I was just like, wow, this is pointless. This is absolutely pointless.
I think for people like you, Kevin, that, you know, talking about cerebral, I mean, I feel like that fits you. And you're very thoughtful. I don't know that you can really be talked out of your feelings necessarily like that. But I don't know how helpful it would be for you. And then obviously, like, if it didn't help, then it wasn't helpful. So it's not a good technique for you. And then I move on, do something else.
That is definitely what I did.
But for, you know, for some people, like they do quite literally need to be taught how to stop thinking in the thought patterns that have been inscribed in their brain. Right. Like you will meet these people, you know, we all have in like activist circles where everything that they experience, they will somehow view through a lens of where they have been slighted somehow. But on the outside, looking in, you're like, I just don't understand how you're seeing it that way. That's not how anyone else is seeing it. You're having a very big response to this. You're having a disproportionate response to what has happened in actuality.
Catastrophizing.
Yeah, sure. That's a word that you could use. And these thought processes for them are automated. They're not thinking about them. Like it's a way that has been ingrained within their thought pattern from a young age, and a kind of therapy that tries to help them not go down those same roads that they have been going down for so many years can be helpful. They literally do need to be told, stop thinking this way. It's not serving you. It's making your life awful. It's making people around you very frustrated. It's not good in any sort of way. And so for those sort of people, like that can be helpful, but it's not helpful for when someone is depressed because they, it's not necessarily a thought pattern. Like it's a brand new symptom in their life. Like they're a 40-year-old person that has really never been depressed, but yeah. They've always had pretty good coping strategies for the sort of day-to-day issues that come up in their life, but now they're just completely overwhelmed with very significant things that are outside of their control. Like they got fired from their job and their partner is leaving them. And now they've started drinking too much. You know, so on and so forth. That isn't the kind of person that just needs to be told, like, what if you just were happy though?
Put me on blast, man.
Hey, Kevin and I were in similar situations.
Yeah. So that's not really what CBT is when they kind of meme it that way, but I can understand why people see it that way. But I guess to defend it, even, you know, this sort of memed version of it, it that literally can be helpful for people.
Jason, actually, you had similar experience with people telling you, have you ever tried just not being sad?
Yeah, when I say people telling you, I mean like your therapist.
I mean, yeah, my therapist, friends, all kinds of. And I've basically just learned to really not talk about this stuff, that stuff very much with most people, because mm-hmm. it's like the most infuriatingly, maddeningly stupid advice.
Yeah. But, you know, the left that critiques CBT in that way do their own version of that, that they don't even know that they're doing. They will say, well, CBT is just, you know, you thinking better thoughts. Instead, what you should do is exercise. And it's like, well, okay, right. man, like, I know that probably would be helpful, but, you know, my depression is part of the reasons why I don't exercise.
Right.
It makes me not motivated to do anything.
Right.
Especially go to like these weird Globo gyms. Right.
Right.
So they fall into that same sort of logic too, of just what if instead of bad behavior, you did good behavior, you know?
Right. The thing about being profoundly depressed is that all of those things, inside of you, your relationship to yourself, that gives you the agency to do in the world, is not working. There's a profound confusion right in the middle of the road. And the other side of the road is where you're self-activated. You go to the gym, you join things, you know, you talk to people, and you can't get there, you know, because you don't know how to, whatever, you know, get the idea.
Yeah. One of the kind of other schools of therapy, the behavioralists, they're much more like action focused, and they will ask you like very concretely, what is it you wish you were doing? Like what is the problem in your life? And if your life was better, what more would it look like? And say like going to the gym or something. And then they will start constructing ways of helping you do those behaviors. You know, like as the name would imply, like behavioralists, like they're very focused on like, how do I get you in the motion of behaving in a way that's more in line with your values and what a better life would look like, and so on and so forth. There's all sorts of different flavors for things that will work for different people potentially.
Interestingly enough, the behavioralists are also reacting to a strictly biological framework, right? They're actually saying, oh, it is a kind of social structural thing about the way you live and the environment around you and how active you are. And just to selfishly return to my question earlier about the insights and deficits of anti-psychiatry. So just to get us all back to what I was saying, Danielle Carr says the anti-psychiatry movement's biggest failure was that it took the biological to be the opposite of the political rather than a site where politics happens. And I think that's kind of what you're describing, that the left is doing a lot in response to whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy or other things. It's opposing politics to something like psychiatry. We were talking about this before we started recording, Byron. Like, there's a limitation to what psychiatry is even supposed to be doing. It isn't resolving large structural and societal and social problems. It is dealing with a limited field.
Yeah, I mean, I'm dealing with the person that's in the chair opposite the table of me, right? And then helping them within like the scope that I actually can. And so often you'll hear this left critique of psychiatry that goes something along the lines of, you are taking these disenfranchised people, these people that have legitimate grievances about the system that we live in. And instead of channeling that in some sort of productive political endeavor, you're sedating them.
Yeah.
I mean, to some degree, that's... One second.
giving them the literal opiate of the masses.
I had an acting teacher one time tell me that if you're ever on a plane and like a baby starts crying, to just remember that's what we really all wish we were doing.
Dude, the next week we're going to be those people that bring their crying baby on a plane.
Hell yeah.
I'll never understand people who get on planes without headphones. It's like the easiest thing in the world.
Just to finish the thought, would it ultimately be helpful for them to go and join their local left? I'm not even sure which organization they would join now. I don't relate to one, so I don't even know which one I'd recommend. But to ultimately, like, would it be more helpful for them to engage in some sort of like revolutionary politics where they create a new world? Yeah, probably. Am I actually supposed to say that to the person that's sitting across the table from me? Where would that leave them? Would that in itself not be its own disappointment when they go and join the DSA and or whichever organization and deal with the cluster that can be and the not new world they end up creating? Like, that's its own blow.
Right.
They are coming to me and saying, I need help. I can't function in my day-to-day life. Like, I'm about to kill myself. Or, can you help me with that? And then I'm trying to figure out how I can.
Even if it's not like the worst case scenario, your local left group, like the DSA or any group, but the DSA tries to become the thing that your therapy sessions should be. So then people start to think of the left as an alternative lifestyle.
Yeah.
As their therapy sessions. And it's just not what it's for, like, at all.
Right.
Right.
That's sort of Christopher Lash's criticism of the new left is you know, the whole therapeutic culture of leftist activism in the, I guess he's talking about the 1960s and 70s, but it certainly applies to us now.
I think it applies more now. Yeah.
Yeah.
to look at someone who's suffering mentally and emotionally and to relate that necessarily and essentially to alienation and other things related to it, and atomization, doesn't mean that disalienating them, sending them to a union hall or something else, is going to be the medicine they need right away. And a very severely, you know, and desperately suffering person isn't going to be the most effective member of that group anyway. You have to kind of build them up. Like, it's not one foul swoop.
Right.
And the culture of the left, you know, it does need to be a pleasant and an exciting place to be. It needs to feel good to be a part of, but it can't be therapeutic.
I think it can be and should be therapeutic, but not, that shouldn't be, that's not its purpose. Like, if you're engaged in solidarity with another worker who's going through something, invariably, you would hope there'd be some solidarity that extends beyond kind of a very shallow definition. But that doesn't mean that you join the group to get therapy.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, I concur. Yeah. And, you know, oftentimes people say those sort of things, it feels very disconnected from the kind of people that I see at work. Like this last week, I had a patient that, you know, their auditory hallucinations were so severe that they had harmed themselves in a very grievous way. And like, just like looking at that person and thinking, well, this wouldn't happen under socialism. I just think that that's a total fantasy. I mean, just pure delusional fantasy. Maybe there would be a less incidence. I don't even know how, you know, there are some thoughts about schizophrenia having some environmental, like social components to it.
Like, well, it's also just it, like, it doesn't even matter, you know, like, okay, yeah, sure. Fine. It's not, it wouldn't happen under socialism. Fine. Let's accept it. But what is that going to do for anybody
now? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was a point that we made in the episode that we did with Adam, is that, like, yeah, sure. Like, changing the world for the better would make everyone's mental health better. But like, right. we've also got to cope now right. while we're here. And it's like, and I would say that it's, you actually had criticisms of that episode, Byron, because of the, something that we said about the medical model being like, I guess there was one of the articles that we read was heavily critical of the medical model. And you're like, well, you know, it shouldn't be completely discounted because of these merits, et cetera. I don't remember. Right. It was through a text message about like a year and a half ago or something. So
I'm trying to think about it too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was probably along these same lines. Yeah, it's
what we're talking about now.
Like I was saying earlier, you know, antidepressants aren't really effective for mild to moderate depression any more than therapy is. It really doesn't break past therapy or placebo until you get to severe depression. But when you look at things like mania or psychotic depression or schizophrenia, or, you know, these sort of things, you're not going... it's hard to conceive of exactly how there isn't going to be a medical component there. Their symptoms are so severe. They're so life altering, and there's clearly a biological component to it that on some level it is still going to occur even in the best of worlds.
Yeah.
And you know, in particular, something like mania, every time that person experiences mania, they're having very serious damage to their brain, and it needs to be responded to quickly. You know, mania untreated can go on for weeks to months, and in that time, they'll put themselves or others in serious danger. And the way you respond to that is medical. It is not. It's hard to conceive of how else you would respond to it. Right. You know, people often say like, I'm bipolar. And then what do you mean by that? They're like, well, sometimes they get grumpy, you know, on a dime. And it's like, that's not what mania is. It's not bipolar. But, you know, mania, like a true episode of mania, they'll go 5 days a week not sleeping. They will not stop talking. They'll have something that we call pressured speech. Where you are absolutely amazed that they can continue to talk this fast for hours, you know. They will engage in extremely risky behaviors. They'll be very grandiose and think they're a god. That will inform their risky behaviors. I mean, you when you look at it, you know that there's something biologic happening here, and that it's going to require a medical response.
I mean, and that's the part of the problem, like with this. Giving everybody a vocabulary that they've got no idea what it actually applies to, and allowing everyone to self-diagnose and then use that as part of their identity, is that I think that now it's sort of like the seriousness of these disorders is lessened by the people who are claiming to have them that don't have any idea what they actually are. And I don't know if that's more... certainly that's a problem for you, Byron, but for the rest of us, it's just fucking annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I don't have a problem telling patients, like, no, your self-diagnosis is wrong, and you should be thankful for that.
Probably feels good.
It is more complicated in your personal life, where you probably shouldn't say that sort of thing, and... you are probably accurately picking up on the fact that this is being done because it provides some sort of social cachet and might even be used as a way to gloss over some antisocial personality, you know, traits and behaviors and how that impacts political organizing. You know, I mean, I think we've probably all seen some of that.
Having this vocabulary, like I mentioned before, that everyone likes to apply to, like the pathologization of everyday life, one of the ways that it occurs, and that's particularly harmful on the left specifically, is to associate every disagreement with abuse and to consider anyone who disagrees with you, either they're gaslighting you because they don't think the same thing that you do, So that's gaslighting, or they're like, they're narcissistic because they're selfish sometimes, or et cetera, whatever. Like those sorts of things, like giving people, oh yeah, he's a sociopath because I cried and he didn't care. Things like that, you know?
Right.
Yeah. The pathologizing of, yeah, everyday events is a problem. And gaslighting is, I mean, it is, I don't know how y'all feel about it, but when I hear it, the vast majority of the time, what I'm really hearing is that two people disagree about what happened, and that's it.
Yeah, that's, I would say about 95% of the time, that's what it is. There are real instances of it where, like, you know, an abuser will trick someone into thinking something in a relationship for a long time. They'll get out of it and they'll see the other side and be like, wow, that's totally different than what was actually happening. But yes. I feel like that's rare. It certainly can't be everyone who's ever been in a relationship has an abusive partner that's gaslighting them.
Yeah. It requires for the other person to be like intentionally doing some of those acts when in reality, they probably aren't, or it's just as mundane as me and you don't see eye to eye as to how these events unfolded. You see a lot of therapy language kind of, to use another overused term, weaponized and used against each other in activist circles. I'm sure we can all think of examples, but certainly not helpful.
No, we really can thank TikTok for a lot of this, because I've seen those. These are five ways to tell whether or not someone you know is a narcissist. It's like, yes, sometimes they're nice to you, other times they're mean, you know. Yep. they put themselves first in situations. I'm like, dude, you're talking about like literally everyone in the world. Like everyone is a narcissist, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. I guess I was just, so we're talking a lot about the most egregious stuff is coming from this sort of online cottage industry, think pieces and influencers. That's obviously I don't think that's going anywhere. It's going to make your job a lot harder and more complicated in many ways. But if these are structural issues and one of the solutions is providing actual health care to people that need it, which is a whole spectrum of severe to things that are socially based and just need some community support, that the answer isn't remote. Like, as much as we want to criticize and critique the system we live under capitalism, the answer isn't, you know, the failures of anti-psychiatry to remove and deinstitutionalize and defund and go looking to the future. If we're talking about not just a purely negative utopia in which we defer everything to after the revolution, what are the structural solutions? If we need more therapists, we don't need more of the same kind of therapists, because we've all had shitty therapists.
I don't know that we need more. I mean, I'm not saying we don't need more therapists, but if I could have my druther, if I could do anything, it wouldn't be that. I wouldn't. I would not create more psychiatry. I wouldn't create more of me. Again, talking about like hard endpoints, death by suicide, the rate of death by suicide has essentially just been going up for decade on decade, while access to people like me have also been going up. That's not that, you know, that, you know, you can't take too much into that. Maybe it would go up even more if people like me weren't around. It's hard to say, but there have been studies that really hint towards that you increase psychiatrists in the community, and it probably does not help in particular suicide rate. We're really bad at risk stratifying people and screening for it and all these sorts of things. But I'm getting away from the point. I would not create more psychiatrists. That's not what I would do. I would try and figure out how to get people to touch grass. Really, I would want people to focus on their friends and their family and their community, and figuring out how to do that. And I think that would take care of 90% of these things.
Well, that sort of circles back around to something that I was saying earlier, where, like, I think that getting rid of our society would probably solve about 90% of our mental health issues. And I think that, like, there are things that we can do in trying to rebuild community, get in touch with people that we know and love, and then finding more people to know and love, etc. Right, touching grass, like you said, those are things that we can do personally, like now, before the revolution. But I think that we live in an anti-human system that is not built for flourishing. It's built for extraction of profit, and everything that it does to try to make to convince us that that we're actually living in a good society and that things are okay, like our access to technology, our access to convenience, are actually exacerbating the negative effects of this alienated anti-human society. Yeah. So I think that one of the things that we can do on the left for our own and our families and our friends' mental health right now is quit pretending like the bad shit that capitalism shoves in our fucking faces is actually good. And I think that we've mentioned this before. Like, I saw a post of it by an anarchist friend of mine who was just like, it was like, oh yeah, people aren't going to church as much anymore. And he's like, haha, good. I'm like, is that fucking good? Because if you want to throw it up next to things that people aren't doing anymore, it's like socializing, right, having relationships, having sex, you know, doing things that humans do with each other. They're not doing those things anymore. Churches right. going away is a symptom of communities and socialization in general going away. It's like everything is bad and it's only getting worse. And the trajectory that we're on is going to keep pushing people into, like, it's going to keep driving that suicide rate up, like you said. It's going to keep pushing people into misery, into like an everyday life that feels like it needs to be pathologized, you know? And that's one of the things I'd like to make clear about everything that we've been saying now. It's like, no, you're right. Things are fucking miserable, but it's not because you have some sort of chemical imbalance. And it's not because, it's not because you need to go to more therapy. It's because the world is miserable.
Which isn't to say that like some of those things could not help.
Sure, sure. You know,
but
like I said, that's coping mechanisms.
Like, right. That's about like setting realistic expectations and like what the goals of treatment are. I mean, I don't have happy pills. That's, you know, like drug dealers have happy pills. Like meth can make you really happy in a pill. But but as far as like what I have to offer, that's, you know, a little bit safer in the long term. I certainly don't have that. It's more about helping how severely bummed out through these things that you have accurately, you know, listed as problems, like how bummed out are those going to make you? You can still have sad feelings about these things. I'm not trying to make those things go away. But helping you navigate through life while still identifying these things accurately is more like a realistic goal. And so, yeah, I'm not trying to say that these problems aren't real and don't see a psychiatrist. Or, you know, I think that you should, especially if your symptoms are interfering with your quality of life. There are things that can be done to help you navigate through all this. But the opposite of this is purely biological. It has nothing to do with the society that we live in. Like that's also fake and wrong.
Right. Got to be dialectical about our approach to dealing with mental health and changing society.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
I would leave people with this final thought, is that the essence of mental illness is a contradiction between the particular system of the soul, you know, with all of its finiteness and dependence, and the universality of life. Yeah. That's Hegel.
Thank you, my
hell yeah.
Of course it's Hegel.
Без нас некому будет установить порядок.